Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by getting an update on the COVID pandemic in South Africa, a country of almost 60 million people. South Africa has had 51,110 deaths and over 1.5 million cases. The Bikasisa Center for Health Journalism's Aisha Abdul Karim and Joan Van Dyke report that the AstraZeneca vaccine does not offer enough protection against the South African variant. Luckily, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines not only offer enough protection, but also prevents severe disease. They write, quote, "It has been a dizzying year of discoveries that has pushed our tiny team to its limits. Clearly, it is far from over," end quote. The Bikasisa Center for Health Journalism in Johannesburg, South Africa, is one of the few media outlets in the Global South specializing in solutions-based narrative features and analysis. They not only uncover problems, but they evaluate the solutions meant to fix them. And joining us now is Mia Milan, founding editor-in-chief of the Bikasisa Center for Health Journalism. Hi, Mia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, 1 year ago yesterday, the coronavirus crisis was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization and has been just devastating all over the world. The vaccines are providing much needed relief, but equity and global access is a major, major issue, which we will discuss. I briefly mentioned what is happening with the vaccine in South Africa, but can you tell us more? So the AstraZeneca vaccine did not protect against the variant, but the Johnson & Johnson vaccines do?
Yes. So what happened in South Africa was that our government bought AstraZeneca vaccines in early January, and about a week after the vaccines arrived in the country, the results of a small study in South Africa on the AstraZeneca vaccine was released. And that showed that when it comes to mild to moderate COVID caused by the variant that has been identified in South Africa, it only provides 10% protection, the AstraZeneca vaccine, against this. We don't yet know what the protection is for severe COVID, but in that light, the government then decided that we shouldn't use the AstraZeneca vaccine because it provides very little protection against some forms of COVID. And we then switched to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because at that time the Johnson & Johnson results were released, and it showed that the vaccine provides very good protection against severe COVID caused by the variant, about 85% protection. And that's really what you want in a pandemic, because severe COVID is the type of COVID that make people end up in hospital or make them die. And that's really what you want to prevent. So at the moment, our regulator, which would be the equivalent of the FDA in the United States, has not yet approved the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for wider rollout in the country. So what we're doing at the moment is we have an implementation trial, because approval for that is a bit easier because it's only in a clinical setting and there are fewer requirements for that. So we started in mid-February to vaccinate health workers, and we have done 140,000 so far. And we are aiming to, before our third wave, which would be around about May, June, to have all our health workers vaccinated. Our government has signed a contract with Johnson & Johnson for more vaccines, but until it's registered in the country, we can't get them in. But that's really not the only problem. As you mentioned, there is a severe shortage of vaccines in the world. And the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, 11 million that we have procured, would by no means arrive in the country in March, or it also wouldn't arrive all in one batch, because there's such a severe shortage and because richer countries are in the position to pay more and to have procured vaccines earlier before the results were available, and could take a risk to pay up for the vaccines, even if they would have turned out not to be effective. Poorer countries couldn't do that. So we were a little later in the queue, and our orders are way behind that of richer countries. So when we have bilateral deals with companies now, we have to wait longer for the vaccines. And we're also getting a few through COVAX, which is an international procurement mechanism of the World Health Organization. But COVAX can only give enough vaccines this year for countries that are part of it for 20% of their population. And our vaccines that we procured through COVAX, a large part of that were AstraZeneca vaccines that we now can't use. So the only vaccines that we currently can get through COVAX is Pfizer vaccines, and it's a very small amount. It's only 113,000.
I listened to a talk you gave recently about what is happening in South Africa, and you say that there's so much inequality in South Africa. And of course, that has affected who has gotten COVID and who doesn't, because a lot of people cannot social distance. How is that going to affect who actually gets the vaccine in South Africa?
So it's interesting what you're saying, because of the inequality, you know, it was richer people who brought COVID into the country, because those were the people who could afford to travel overseas and then come back with a virus. But when it came to community spread in South Africa, obviously in areas where people live in very small, informal houses, and it's really like 10 or 15 people within, you know, a very small room, those people literally couldn't social distance. And in addition to that, you know, they didn't have access to running water to wash their hands. Now, when it comes to the access to vaccines, what affects how you have access to it is that the poorer people in the country is reliant on a public health system, which is not, is very under-resourced. That's about 86% of the country. So most of South Africa is poor. And then 15% of the country can afford medical insurance and can have access to a private healthcare system that is really very, very well resourced. So when it comes to access to the these vaccines, people who don't have medical insurance and whose medical insurance can't pay for these would need to access mostly their vaccines at public health facilities. They would also be able to access it elsewhere, but the preference would be public health facilities. And those facilities are far more crowded than what you would find at a private health facility. So when it comes to access, traditionally in South Africa, someone who uses the public health system would queue much longer. There would be a much longer line and far fewer nurses to serve you than with what the case would be in a private health system. So when it comes to access, it would be not as nice a setting to access the vaccines, but the government in South Africa is the only institution that's allowed to procure vaccines. And if the private sector wants vaccines in the country, they would have to buy it from the government. So there would definitely not be a situation where the poorer people would not have access to vaccines. It might just be that they queue in a longer queue. But the structure that has been created in South Africa, I'm pretty confident, will ensure that everyone will have access to it. And it has been established that no one is allowed to, everyone gets it free at the point of access. So even people with medical insurance, their medical insurance can't ask them to first pay and then claim back. The institution where they go, if it's a chemist or a pharmacy, would have to claim it back directly from their medical insurance. So no one would be paying for a COVID vaccine. And in that sense, it wouldn't affect the access for poorer people.
Can you talk also about the lockdowns and how that has affected people? Because in the beginning, South Africa had one of the most restrictive lockdowns in the world. And the piece that I mentioned in the intro says that for many, the lockdown was just horrifying because people in abusive relationships were trapped with their abusers 24/7. I mean, we saw horrible stories in, you know, all over the world on this issue. So tell us a little bit about how the lockdown has affected South Africa and what the situation is like today.
Sure. So you're absolutely right. We had one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. It was so strict that the sale of alcohol was banned. The sale of tobacco was banned, and you really couldn't move anywhere outside of your house for 2 months other than to go and buy food or to go to the doctor. And because South Africa is a country was of such huge inequality, the lockdown had very different effects on different parts of the country. So people who live in middle-class suburbs, you know, might have suffered, for instance, a little bit of a loss of income. And, you know, we didn't have freedom to move around and socialize, but it was bearable because they might have had savings and they could work from home because they have the type of jobs that you can do over the internet, that you can do when you sit at home. The poorer people in the country have manual jobs. So it's not jobs that you can do from home. You work in a mine and you physically have to go there, or you clean someone's house and you would have to go there, and now you can't and you simply don't get a salary. So the impact in poorer areas literally meant that people didn't have food. We saw a lot of hunger. The government had to provide food parcels to people. NGOs had to provide food parcels, not just the government. And it really had a severe impact in terms of just surviving. A large part of South Africa is unemployed and really relies on social grants from the government. And during lockdown, there were very strict rules and sometimes ridiculous rules. For instance, rules that say only 30 people a day can visit an office in a certain area for their social grants, when there are thousands of people that need the grants. So people had to go without it, or people started queuing and lining up through the night to get a spot to be one of the 30 people. And it was in the middle of winter, so it was cold. So they started to, you know, they made fires and sat around it, and they hugged and wanted to keep each other warm, basically. But that was horrible for COVID, because that's how you're going to get the virus. So it even was an environment where if you were poor and you wanted to access a social grant, then you were in a situation where you're even more likely to get COVID. For instance, if they wanted to queue to some people could get their grants from, say, an ATM machine, and people had to queue like for miles to get it. And now they had to stand very long, you know, distance, do social distancing from each other. Another good example of how COVID, the lockdown, affected people differently in the country is schooling. So all of a sudden schools were closed and you could either not go to school or you could do school from home. If you were in a well-resourced, a semi-private or a private school in South Africa, you could have your classes over Zoom and the teachers would be trained to how to teach over Zoom and you would have access to internet at home. But if you lived in a poorer area and your mother or father was a domestic worker or was a mine worker, you were highly unlikely to have had internet access at home. So what it meant was, is that for almost 6 months, you didn't go to school. You had absolutely no education. There were efforts, you know, to have classes on television and that sort of thing. But you could imagine that that is not one-on-one education. It's a very different type of education, and it's a mass thing and less effective. So if you had to measure, if you were poor last year, what was the effect on your education? And if you were a middle-class person in South Africa, it's two very, very different things. And the school year that then started this year for a new grade would be very different in terms of challenges, and it's directly influenced by how much money you earn or your parents earn.
Yeah, we were reading the piece from Amnesty International, the report, Failing to Learn Lessons, the Impact of COVID on a Broken and Unequal Education System. And it says South Africa's schooling system is so under-equipped that the pandemic has all but ended education for many students, especially those from disadvantaged communities. Unless urgent access is taken, the future livelihoods of an entire generation will be at risk. So how is the government responding to this?
So, you know, the government did make certain arrangements last year. For instance, our senior year, the final year of high school, wrote their exams 3 months later than what they would normally have written it, so that there was more time to catch up on their schoolwork. You know, after our first wave, many children returned to school, and there was some opportunity to catch up on it. They, as I've mentioned, there have been, you know, efforts to have classes done by teachers over television. And the other effect in schools was that a large part of children in South Africa rely on school feeding schemes to get food. It might be their only meal for the day. And when the schools closed down, it all of a sudden meant there was no food for them, because where would they find food then? So there was a lot of pressure from civil society then on the government to make sure that those food schemes continue, whether the school is open or not, because it was the only way to access food. And compare that to private schools in South Africa, and you also have semi-government schools where you pay a little bit of money for the school, so it's better resourced. Those schools just continued. You know, it was the only difference was you do it from home, but you had all the education that you would have had, you know, before COVID. So in that sense, there is a situation in South Africa where even on university or college level, it is so obvious that if you don't have money and you had to also on that level, even a tertiary level, study from home, you may very well have run out of data. You know, you would have accessed internet via your phone and buy data. And the situation of a middle-class person would be that they have a fiber line at home and can access the internet. So with university, I think there were many students that didn't pass as a direct result of the fact that they weren't resourced enough to study well from home. There was efforts to intervene with that, for instance, to have some sort of tutoring over a phone or a little bit over the one-on-one tutoring over the internet. But to address all of that for such a large part of the population is a very difficult thing to do. So in the end, poorer people suffered more. It's just like, it's just how it is, than more resourced people.
Right. I hear you talking, and we're dealing with the same issues here in the United States. For people who don't, I mean, just to give people some numbers from Global Citizen, 1 in 5 South Africans are living in extreme poverty, according to the UN. The country's wealthiest 10% own more than half of the national income.
Yes, that is unfortunately the case in South Africa, and it's reflected everywhere. It's reflected in the education that I've mentioned. It's reflected in the health system. If you look at how money for health is distributed in the country, about 8% of South Africa's GDP is spent on health. And half of that 8% is spent on private healthcare, and half of it is spent on public healthcare. But if you look at the numbers served by those two sectors, then it boils down to 4% of the money spent on healthcare goes to 15% of the country, and the other 4% goes to 86% of the country. So you could imagine what kind of healthcare the 86% gets compared to the 15% or the 14%. And that is actually a very good visual description of how unequal South Africa is. And it's something that we're trying to change and to help to empower people who weren't previously empowered. But it's a slow process, and it's a process that the government hasn't always handled well. And there's a lot of criticism in South Africa around it, and also a lot of frustration and impatience. If you, for instance, look at something like land distribution in South Africa, you know, wealthier people basically own their own land, and poor people just have nothing, or they have community land that it's not necessarily on their name. So there's a lot of impatience in South Africa with wanting to have land that some part of the population perceives, and rightly so, as something that has been stolen from them, to have that returned. And there is a law that will soon be passed that will allow for land to be returned without compensation to the owners, which is a controversial issue in South Africa, but is also an example of just how frustrated people are with a slow pace of change.
Today, we are speaking with Mia Milan, founding editor-in-chief of the BKCSA Center for Health Journalism. It's one of the few media outlets in the Global South specializing in solutions-based narrative features and analysis based in Johannesburg, South Africa. And we're talking about the COVID pandemic in South Africa. I also wanted to ask you about corruption. In one of your recent talks, you talked about massive corruption with personal protective equipment. And just to give listeners some context, I'm reading from a CNN piece last month. A South African inquiry into corruption during Jacob Zuma's time in power is seeking the former president's imprisonment for 2 years after he defied a summons and court order to appear and give evidence. One allegation is that he allowed businessmen close to him, his brothers, to plunder state resources and influence policy. Can you give us a little context and talk about corruption with PPE?
Sure. So, yes, there has been a lot of corruption around PPE, and it's really been widespread. So because it was a state of disaster, like, you know, other countries had the same situation, there were more relaxed rules when it came to procurement. You know, there were rules that weren't as strict as to how you have to deal with tenders. So it was easier to cheat, basically. And in South Africa, in the kind of governance structure that we have, we have 9 provinces, and each province could procure their own PPE. So there were 9 provincial levels where there was opportunity for corruption. And people really took advantage of it. To give you an idea of how widespread it was, is that 2 health ministers in our provinces were suspended because they seemed to be involved in some of this corruption through family members. The spokesperson of our president at the moment, her husband seemed to be involved in some procurement issues, and she was then suspended. So it was even government people that were involved in it, and even in the health field, people who were supposed to be the people who prevent the corruption was even involved in it. So I'm not just me, experts and civil society are really hoping that we can learn from those procurement lessons and how they allowed for corruption when it comes to vaccines. So one of the differences that's been implemented now is when it comes to vaccine procurement in South Africa, the system is now different. You can only procure nationally. So province can't go and buy their own vaccines. They have to get it from the national government. And the hope is that there will be more control over it. And it's really happened, as you mentioned, against that background of what we call state capture in South Africa, because during the Zuma administration, there were so many people who were employed in very strategic positions so that corruption could be easier and certain contracts could be signed off in an easier way. So there were lots of people in positions of power who were part of that state capture. And we've had a commission of inquiry in South Africa. It's called the Zondo Commission, that has been going on for more than a year to hear about what happened and to uncover about just exactly what happened during that era. So when the PPE corruption happened, it was a very discouraging thing for people in South Africa, because the new government of Cyril Ramaphosa was seen as a government that will try and get rid of this corruption. And then in the middle of a pandemic, where you would expect people to help others, this corruption happened. So it was something that people were very discouraged by. And it's something that we really, really hope wouldn't happen in the case of vaccines, especially when it comes to tenders to distribute the vaccines, you know, when they arrive in the country to distribute them to the provinces. We're really hoping that we have better systems to check those tenders now. And there's definitely stricter rules in place now for that. And to hope that none of that would be repeated or not be repeated on the same level at the very least.
And before we let you go, Mia, I wanted to ask you about vaccine equity. According to reports, about 80 countries around the world will not have access to the vaccine until the year 2023. So not even next year, but the year after. And this is unacceptable for so many reasons. I mean, it's not fair that I should get a vaccine simply because I live here in California. I was really surprised, though, to read one of your pieces written by Ahmed Kalabi, What Happens If Some Countries Don't Vaccinate? And Ahmed writes that some countries like Tanzania and Madagascar have issued statements saying they don't have plans to vaccinate their populations. Can you just quickly tell us what that's about?
So the presidents of the two countries don't necessarily believe that there is COVID in the country. So in Tanzania specifically, the leadership has sort of denied the existence of COVID, and there are really no measures around it. You know, no mask wearing is compulsory, no public health measures, because the leader of the country doesn't believe it is there, similar to sort of like a Brazilian situation. And in Madagascar, their leader, as you may recall, very early on in the COVID pandemic, developed his own cure, what he calls a cure. It's obviously not a real cure, but for COVID, a little tonic that you drink, and he distributed it to everyone in the country. And he claims it can also prevent COVID. So they don't have evidence-based responses and not leaders who believe in the science around it, which is why they are not very determined to get vaccines, because how do you get a vaccine to prevent you from getting something if you don't believe the disease exists, but or is caused by or if you think you have a cure against it. But as you've mentioned, vaccine inequity is a huge thing, and it's also something that means that many, many countries will have access to vaccines is a much later stage than richer countries. And the sadness about this is not just the inequity, it's that it's also a little bit silly, in the sense that scientifically, if you want to prevent variants from emerging, new variants that are more infectious as the ones that have been identified in the UK and South Africa and Brazil, you want to prevent the virus from making copies from itself, because the more copies a virus can make of itself, the more opportunities there are for mutations and changes, and then for variants to develop. And if you have pockets in the world that are vaccinated, it doesn't help that they're vaccinated if you're going to have variants developing in countries that don't have access to the vaccines, because those variants, as we've seen with the variant in South Africa and the UK, spread at the speed of light. They're going to end up in the other countries. So it is not a good approach to have pockets of little vaccinated countries. The way we need to approach this COVID is as a pandemic. So a pandemic where you make sure everyone has access to vaccines and everyone gets vaccinated. And until we do that, we're not going to end the pandemic, unfortunately. And at the moment, we're definitely not there yet, because we see very few people in Africa that have been vaccinated. Many countries can really only afford vaccines through COVAX. They can't even dream of having a bilateral deal with a pharmaceutical company. And we see richer countries where, you know, America aims to be vaccinated by the end of May. I don't think South Africa would have vaccinated 10% of its population by May. And that is a huge inequity. And South Africa is much richer than most of Africa. Imagine what's going to happen there and the other countries.
Well, that is an angle that deserves far more attention. Mia Milan is founding editor-in-chief of the Bikasisa Center for Health Journalism, one of the few media outlets in the Global South specializing in solutions-based narrative features and analysis. They are located in Johannesburg, South Africa. Mia, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back. I learned so much from your website. So thank you to you and your team.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. And coming up after a break, we are going to talk about the Republican Party's efforts in this country, the Republican Party, to take voter suppression to new extremes. We will be joined by Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Now we are going to talk about voter suppression efforts. Today's guest, Ari Berman, reports that Republicans are taking voter suppression to new extremes. They have introduced 253 bills with provisions that restrict voting access in 43 states, according to a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice. Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones, where he covers voting rights, and he's the author of Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Well, great to have you, Ari. Before we dive in and talk about these attacks on voting rights, I just want to ask you about the $1.9 trillion relief package that was signed by President Biden last night. It's been called one of the most progressive packages ever written into law. And you've actually been tweeting about this over the past 6 months, 6 to 8 months, about how Republicans are spending so much time on voter suppression and not much time on actually helping people who are suffering so much.
Well, that's absolutely right. They've been fixated on no evidence of voter fraud to introduce a sweeping number of voter suppression bills, but they have been completely ignoring the worst mass casualties in American history, 500,000 plus dead. And it's just incredible. There were two documented cases of voter fraud, and there's been 253 new bills introduced to restrict voting rights in the first 2 months of this year, but there's 530,000 dead Americans, and they can't vote for COVID relief. So basically, you have a Republican Party that is fixated on Dr. Seuss and cancel culture and suppressing votes at a time when Americans, thousands of Americans, are dying every single day. I mean, it's hard to think of a worse and more stronger indictment of a party than this.
And not a single Republican voted for this relief bill, not one.
Not one. And I mean, honestly, if Donald Trump had proposed the same thing, which he kind of did in a lot of ways, I'm sure a lot of them would have voted for this. So again, in the same way that when you make it easier to vote, you help everybody, vaccinating people is not like you're just vaccinating Democrats. I mean, Joe Biden is making it so that everyone can get vaccinated, everyone can get relief, everyone can have their kids go back to school. This is not a left or right thing. This is not a Democratic or Republican thing. We've learned in the last year the virus does not care what party you are, does not care what color you are, does not care where you grow up. So, I mean, the fact that zero Republicans think that we need COVID relief, given how much people are struggling and given that 530,000 Americans have died, is just really, really stunning.
Well, and it's also going to be so interesting to see how people respond to this, you know, especially people who are not online all day. They're not on social media. The Atlantic's Annie Lowry said she talked to a number of parents who are going to get the child tax relief, and they had no idea that it's even coming. So I think people are going to get money and they're not even going to expect it.
Well, and you saw that unlike Donald Trump, Joe Biden doesn't want to put his name on the checks because he doesn't care about the political credit. He cares about the policy, which is a refreshing change in this country. But there's so many important provisions on it, and I'm not an expert on it either. And I had to read up on a lot of stuff that's in the bill. So I hope that this administration sells the bill. We saw that Barack Obama back in 2009, when they passed the stimulus legislation, did not do a good job of selling that. This is, I think, even more impactful than that stimulus bill was. They did not water it down to get Republican support, which I think was really smart. They did what they thought needed to be done to actually solve the problem, given the scale of the problems that we faced. And so I think the president's going to have to sell this bill. It seems like he's going on the road to sell it. But the good news is, 76% of Americans already support it. And according to the polling, 60% of Republicans support it. So even though no Republicans supported it in Congress, I think a lot of these provisions are going to be very popular, even among Republican voters.
Well, we are going to do an in-depth show about this bill next Wednesday, so be sure to tune in for that. Before we dive in and talk about these new bills, voter suppression bills at the state level, Ari, given that you spend so much time on this issue, remind us what happened in the November election. What really scared Republicans, because I keep thinking about what Senator Lindsey Graham told Fox in November. He said, Republicans will never win another presidential election if they don't, quote, do something about mail-in voting.
Well, I think what really scared them was that we had record turnout in 2020. And in spite of all the barriers in the pandemic, we had the highest turnout since 1900, which is remarkable given how many people couldn't vote in 1900, that women, most African-Americans, most people of color were not able to vote in 1900. And so we had record turnout. We had extremely diverse electorate in states like Georgia, states like Arizona. And I think it was that victory that really freaked Republicans out. And then they started pointing to the voting methods that they believe that Democrats used in higher numbers. Now, there was nothing inherently partisan about mail voting before 2020. The parties used mail voting in about equal numbers. Republicans actually used it more than Democrats in places like Arizona and in Florida. But once Democrats started using mail voting and other methods of voting in higher numbers than Republicans, Republicans started blaming those methods of voting, scapegoating them for Donald Trump's loss, and then very quickly after are trying to now restrict those methods of voting.
And as you report, Georgia is now ground zero for the GOP's escalating war on voting, targeting the voting methods that were used most by Democratic voters in 2020 and which contributed to flipping the state blue and electing two Democratic senators.
Yeah, and in Georgia is a fascinating test case because remember, Donald Trump asked the Georgia Secretary of State to find 11,000 votes. And basically what Republican legislatures are trying to do in Georgia is find 11,000 votes by suppressing Democratic votes in future elections. Even though they wrote the law expanding mail voting back in 2005, they are now trying to repeal no excuse absentee voting, so only a very small segment of the population can vote by mail, even though 1.3 million people in Georgia voted by mail in 2020, including 450,000 Republicans. Georgia Republicans are trying to cut weekend voting hours, including Sunday voting, when Black churches do souls to the polls, get out the vote drives. Black voters are about 30% of the electorate in Georgia, but they were 37% of those that voted on Sundays. This is clearly, they're trying to eliminate voting days that were used more by Democrats and Black voters. They're trying to restrict mail ballot drop boxes, which a lot of people use because they were concerned about the post office. They're trying to take away power from the Republican Secretary of State after he stood up to Trump and give it to the Republican legislature. So they're basically trying to change the entire election system in Georgia, which they wrote and defended. And they defended as recently as the last election because Democrats won the presidential election very narrowly and then won those two Senate races in January.
What is no excuse absentee voting?
No excuse absentee voting is basically what you have in California, which is to say everyone can vote by mail. You don't need a reason to get a mail ballot, which means it's accessible to any voter. What they want to do in Georgia is change that. So you can only vote by mail, for example, if you're out of town, if you have a disability, or if you're over 65. And the over 65 thing to me is really interesting because voters over 65 in Georgia are far wider and more Republican than the state as a whole. So they're basically saying, well, our voters, our most loyal voters, they can still vote by mail. But young and diverse Georgians who vote Democratic, they can't vote by mail anymore. So they're not actually taking away mail balloting from everyone. They're just taking it away from the most Democratic voters, but they're leaving the most core Republican constituencies to be able to vote by mail.
And where is this bill now?
Well, one bill passed the state House and one bill passed the state Senate, and they're slightly different. The bill that passed the state Senate gets rid of what I call no excuse absentee voting. The bill that passed the state House cuts early voting and does some other things. So they have to be reconciled. There may not be support in Georgia for getting rid of no excuse absentee voting because so many Republicans have used it in the past. And the governor, Brian Kemp, says he may not support that. The lieutenant governor doesn't support it. The lieutenant governor actually presides over the state Senate, actually left the chamber when they were debating this bill last week because he opposed this measure. And so this has become very contentious in Georgia. And I think there's something of a disconnect between what Georgia Republicans are doing and what their own voters are doing, because a lot of their own voters used mail voting. A lot of their own voters used early voting, and they could also be hurt by these changes. And so I guess they're just thinking, well, we don't care about how much collateral damage there is to our own voters as long as we think it hurts Democratic voters more.
Wow. Right. Because you report that with the no excuse absentee voting, 1.3 million Georgians used that in 2020, including 450,000 Republicans.
Yeah. And I would be worried if I was a Republican about taking away a voting method that so many of my voters use just because the other side used it more. I mean, if Donald Trump hadn't told Republicans not to vote by mail, they could have easily voted by mail as much, if not in higher numbers, than Democrats did, like they had done in past elections. And so I think if you look at the Republican electorate, yes, they have exempted Republicans or any voters who are over 65, they can still vote by mail. But I mean, there's a lot of Republicans in rural Georgia that are 62 or 63 or 64 years old that I think would still like to vote by mail and now might not be able to, according to this law. There is a projection that there's 7.6 million voters in Georgia, and this would prevent more than 5 million of them from being able to vote by mail. So it'd be a huge contraction of the voting system in Georgia. And I think mail voting is going to remain popular even when there's not a pandemic, because in places like Georgia, we have seen really long lines at the polls. And if you vote by mail, you don't have to wait in those long lines. And so there's a convenience to mail voting that I think voters are going to like going forward. And I think one of the reasons we had such high turnout in 2020 is because people had so many options to vote. You could vote by mail, you could vote early in most states, and you could vote in person on election day like you usually do. And the fact that there was all that convenience, that seems to be one of the main things that Republicans are trying to change going forward.
How are grassroots organizations responding to these bills in Georgia?
Well, they're very upset about them, and they're causing quite a ruckus. Right now, there's a lot of work targeting the business community in Georgia, and saying, you guys need to step up here in the same way that you have denounced, for example, the bathroom bills in states like North Carolina, targeted anti-abortion bills, spoken out about anti-gay bills. You need to speak out about voter suppression. And, you know, Georgia is a state where people of color are 40% of the population. And they're saying to these big corporations, you can't celebrate Black History Month. You can't celebrate all of these holidays and events, but then give all this money to Republican legislators who are supporting voter suppression, that you need to speak up here. And so I think they're trying to get the business community more involved because they're very influential with Republicans. And obviously Georgia has some huge corporations, Delta, AT&T, et cetera, that are located there. And they're also trying to expose some of these divisions within the Republican Party, because Republicans aren't necessarily on the same page in Georgia about this. Some of them don't want to get rid of no excuse absentee voting. Some of them don't want to cut early voting. So I think they would like to make it more difficult for Democrats to vote, but I think they're worried about hurting their own voters. And they're also worried about the fact that it's very likely that Stacey Abrams is going to run for governor in 2022. And she is going to use this issue to mobilize Democratic voters and to mobilize communities of color and tell them that the Republicans don't want you to vote, and therefore we have to turn out to make sure that doesn't happen in future elections.
Do you know where Georgia Governor Brian Kemp stands on these bills?
Well, he's been pretty mum about it. And it's interesting because in 2018, when Brian Kemp was both Secretary of State and the candidate for governor, instituted a lot of voter suppression methods against Stacey Abrams that benefited him in that race, he was very outspoken in defense of his voter suppression efforts. He's been very quiet about this. I think he knows that this could hurt him politically. And if you listen to the debates in Georgia, there's this really fascinating tension, which is that the Republican Party is nearly an entirely white party in Georgia. And the Democratic Party is a very diverse party in Georgia. Black voters were a majority of voters that cast their ballots for Joe Biden in Georgia. And many of the legislators are Black, and many of them grew up in the Jim Crow era. What they're saying is, we don't want to go back to those days. We don't want to go back to the days of the 50s and 60s when Georgia was defined by segregation. We want to move forward into the new South. We want to move forward into a state that elected Joe Biden, that voted for the first Jewish senator, the first Black senator from Georgia. We want to move forward to that state where people want to return from the North back to the South to live here, because it's an attractive place to live. And so there's this real tension between the old Georgia and the new Georgia that's playing out in the debate over these bills. It's a lot bigger than Georgia. It's a lot bigger than voting. It's about what kind of country we want to be in, what kind of direction we want to go in. And Georgia's a microcosm of that.
Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones, where he covers voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, when you look at those 250 laws aimed at restricting voting in 43 states, what stands out for you? And do you know if any one group is behind them? I mean, years ago, we talked about the American Legislative Exchange Council being behind a lot of these bills, where they're introduced in different states, but they're written exactly the same.
Well, what stands out, number one, is just how big of a number that is. The fact that 250 bills have been introduced in 43 states in the first 2 months of this year, that's seven times higher than the number of bills introduced to restrict voting rights last year. And there were already a lot of efforts to restrict voting rights in the Republican Party. So they have dramatically escalated their war on voting. And what also stands out is just how coordinated this is. This goes way beyond ALEC. The RNC, the Heritage Foundation, the Republican state committees at the state level, they're all now emphasizing, quote unquote, election integrity, which is basically just a code word for voter suppression, as their main issue. There were seven panels at CPAC about election issues. Donald Trump talked about it extensively. He said this was an urgent priority for the Republican Party. So voter suppression has really become the central organizing principle of the Republican Party right now. They don't stand for any policies. They're not trying to solve any of the big problems facing the country. They don't have a plan to deal with 530,000 deaths. They don't have a plan to put people back to work. They don't have a plan to open schools. They have a plan to prevent people from voting. That is the single-minded focus of the Republican Party right now. And that was the focus of the Republican Party before, but it's so much worse now. And the minute I saw Trump started talking about a stolen election, I knew where this was headed. I knew it was going to end up here, because that was the reason why so many Republicans didn't denounce the big lie that the election was stolen. They knew this was going to be useful to them in the future.
Okay, so the next question then is, what about media coverage? It seems that the media are just coming out and calling what it is. I've heard different language from NPR to CNN. In fact, I saw you on CNN, and it seems like the hosts are just, you know, not trying to do the both sidesism thing because it's not a both sides story. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot less both sides coverage in the media than there was before, because it's so obvious what's going on here. I mean, the fact that we had a 2 month campaign to try to overturn the election with no evidence of fraud, the fact that there was an insurrection at the Capitol that was fueled by those lies, and the fact that state after state are now restricting voting rights in such a sudden and coordinated and stunning fashion. I think it's very obvious what the story is. There's no both sides here, because the issue of election integrity was litigated so extensively in 2020 that we can say with such great confidence now that there was no evidence of fraud. I mean, people knew that before, but everyone who looked at the issue came to that same conclusion, including many, many prominent Republicans, Republican judges, Republican officials all over the country. They were saying this. It wasn't just Democrats and liberals that were saying this. It was Republicans that were saying that we had the most secure election in history. And so there's obviously no reason to do this other than to make it harder to vote, because why else would we be doing it if no problems surfaced in 2020? So I think it's easier for the media to cover the story now. I think the issue is just for them to cover it in a sustained way and to cover it with the same urgency that they covered Trump's attempts to overturn the election, because it's a lot more difficult to get people to care about what's happening in the Georgia legislature or the Florida legislature or the Arizona legislature than it is, you know, to have Donald Trump file a lawsuit saying, I'm going to throw out tens of millions of votes.
We have just a few minutes left, but on Wednesday, the House passed H.R. 1, the For the People Act, as you write, the most significant democracy reform bill since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. If these voter suppression laws pass at the state level, how would H.R. 1 deal with them? Would they supersede them?
Yeah, so H.R. 1 would set the rules for voting at a federal level. So states would have to have things like automatic registration and election day registration and early voting and expanded vote by mail at the federal level. And that, in many cases, would supersede the state laws, because it's theoretically possible that states could have different laws for state races and different laws for federal races, but that would be very confusing. So most likely the rules for federal races would be applied across the board. But even if they were just applied to federal elections, I mean, those in many cases are the most important elections. So it would apply to the presidential race and the congressional races and those kind of races. And that's where Congress has the power to act, that we give the states a lot of power in our democracy, but we also say that Congress has the power to set rules for federal elections. And Democrats are using that power, and they're recognizing that voting laws can't vary so dramatically whether you live in Georgia or Texas or California, that there has to be federal protections for voters no matter their geography, or else lots of people are going to be disenfranchised by these new efforts to make it harder to vote.
And what's your read on what will happen with the filibuster here? Because as you report, it is highly improbable that the Democrats will be able to win over 10 GOP votes to defeat a Republican filibuster on this bill.
Well, Democrats are either going to have to get rid of the filibuster to pass H.R. 1, or they're going to have to exempt these bills from the filibuster, which is an idea that Stacey Abrams told me about this week, which is basically to say that Congress has a unique power to regulate federal elections. This is something that's of dire need for our democracy, and therefore we don't have to get rid of the filibuster in all cases, but we have to allow H.R. 1 and the companion bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, to pass, because this is something that only Congress can deal with, and it's such an urgent threat to our democracy. We can't let a relic of Jim Crow stand in the way of blocking the next wave of Jim Crow voter suppression laws.
Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones, where he covers voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, as always, thank you so much for the great information, and thank you for joining us.
Great to talk to you again, Rose. Thank you.
You too. Thank you. Have a nice weekend. And Ari reports in his latest piece about this that Amy Klobuchar, who chairs the Senate Rules Committee, has indicated she was open to eliminating the filibuster, but these comments to Mother Jones are her most definitive statements to date. Through her Democratic colleagues, Senators Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema have said they would not support abolishing the filibuster. Klobuchar says the spread of new anti-voting bills by Republicans boosts the need for the Dems to enact H.R. 1, and that increases the pressure to end or alter the filibuster. And we will be talking about the Senate and the filibuster on next Tuesday's Your Call. And to read more about these new attacks on voting rights by the Republican Party at the state level, you can read Ari's articles at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Damian Miner for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.